experiment, or I believe I'm participating in an experiment, you may also find yourself in collateral damage, so to speak. So I'd like to introduce Brett and Janine, who just want to fill you in and tell you about the form you've been handed out. Brett and or Janine.
Right. Hi, my name's Brett. I'm from the English Language Institute, and I'm here on behalf of my case, a project currently underway at the English Language Institute, or you might know it as the ELI. The ELI, which is located in the Nubbs Building, is a center which focuses not only on teaching, but also on research in the area of English as a second language. My case stands for Michigan Corpus of Academic Spoken English. A corpus is simply a collection of words. As an initial goal, we hope to build my case to the size of 1.5 million words. Eventually, we hope that the collection of linguistic data available in my case will help us to observe patterns of language, patterns which will aid us in developing better tools for the teaching of English as a second language. In keeping with these goals, we are interested in patterns which are observable across the speech of different groups of people. We are not at all interested in any one individual speech. We are not interested in correct or proper speech, but rather in natural speech that is really spoken here at the biostation or the university. We are not at all interested in individual teaching styles or in the content of any particular class. Our presence here is in no way a method of evaluation of this class. We are simply here in order to record spoken academic language for my case. My case has been approved by the Institutional Review Board. We have received the consent of Professor Webb to video and audio tape this class today for the purposes which I have just explained. Names and other identifying information will not be used for this project. If you do not wish to be video and or audio taped, I'd like at this time to give you the opportunity to object. Okay.
Even Jason.
All right, so by your silence, I'm assuming consent, and thank you for your attention.
Do they need to sign the forms, though?
We need each of you to fill out a consent form, if you would, and...
Do they actually need to fill out the top two lines, just go through and X off?
Right, I didn't fill in the top. Well, while you're filling those in, you should know that picking myself as an example has doomed this to failure, because... We had to buy a motor from Cedarville Marine up in the eastern Upper Peninsula this year. And I talked to Nancy there, who's in charge of sales and so on. And she was, everything went through. And then Megan and the rest of the crew who've been working up there went through. And she said, your Mr. Webb talks funny. And says, yes. She says, he's from England. She says, well, you'd think if he was from England, he could speak English without an accent. Anyway.
So if any of you have any questions, you can talk to one of us either after the class or our email with Professor Webb. You could direct questions to us.
I'll give you a couple of minutes because I'd like you to listen to me as well. So have you started taping? Oh, what do you know? Okay, this morning, we're going to continue with the discussion of the factors that determine where fish can live, their physical properties, physiological properties, and so on. We've looked so far at the design of fishes, the way they feed, and those kinds of issues, and we started last time thinking about food and feeding, and the physiological capabilities of fishes, particularly in terms of the way they process energy. Today I'm going to build on that, and we're going to talk about how the environment affects the way fish use energy. the topic this is that is covered, this is often called the Fry paradigm, after a physiologist who worked on fish in Canada, recently died, Fred Fry, who not only was great at collecting fish, but he had the most amazing fern collection, the biggest fern collection of anyone in Canada at the time of his death. I don't know if there was a correlation. Now, we've had strange weather. We've had some cold mornings, we've had some hot mornings. In the morning, if you're cold, what do?
Drink coffee.
Stay in bed. Get out of here.
Dress warmer.
Dress warmer. What about on a hot day? What do you do on a hot day? I'm sorry, I missed that one. Get naked. Okay. Cold shower, is that before or after getting naked? Okay, your responses to the environment then are all behavioural, aren't they? You execute behaviours, you do various things in order to make yourself feel more comfortable. That's the response to various extremes. If you're in the boat well and we're struggling to get the whaler going, you know, you'll start coughing and trying to get away from the fumes and those kinds of things. So your response to a change in the environment is behavioural in order to make yourself more comfortable. And in doing so, you're obviously going to expend energy, for example, that you might have been able to use for something else. For example, swing dancing on Sunday night. However, when we're out in the field and we're looking at fishes, what do we do? What do we measure? What do you, when you want on these sheets, which are describing the habitat, what do you write in there?
Temperature,
weather, all sorts of things. What do you write about the behaviour of the fish? Yeah, but not so much. In other words, when you're feeling uncomfortable and it's hot, is the first thing you think is, oh, it's 90 degrees, time to get naked. Or it's, 50 degrees. Oh, time to stay in bed. So that your decisions are based on a measured thermometer temperature? No. So we have an interesting dichotomy here, in that as part of science, we measure the heck out of everything in order to describe the habitat. Yet, we know from ourselves that organisms don't respond to those things we measure, but rather some effect of what they measure on the physical condition, the comfort in the examples I gave you, those kinds of things. Now, we measure a whole variety of variables really only for one reason, as a standard for communication with other people. So that if I tell you that the temperature is 40 degrees, you, because of your superior knowledge of fishes, that's going to tell you something about the kinds of fish you might find and those sorts of things. So it's a standard for comparison, but it's not the way that an animal sees and responds to the environment itself, nor the way we ourselves see and respond to the environment. So we have a dichotomy in terms of the way we measure the environment, a product of human technology, versus the way we actually respond to the environment. And if you think of human technology and all the devices you can use to describe the technology, there are potentially millions. We've really focused on things such as temperature, but we could have taken dissolved oxygen meters out, except I can tell you from experience most of the water around here is pretty saturated that we look at. We could have measured PCBs and goodness knows what other various poisons that are kicking around. We could have measured a host of things to physically describe the environment, but we haven't. You should be grateful. There's a technological view, though, but the other view is to try and think of the environment the way the animal sees it. and to try and think about an animal's eye view of the environment. And this is what Fred Fry tried to advocate. He said, how do animals respond to the environment? Not what can we measure about the environment, but how do animals respond to the environment? And this led to what fish biologists call Fry's paradigm, in which Fry set up a framework to think about common ways and a common framework whereby fish respond to the environment. And it is an energetic-based system, because ultimately any response you make requires changes in energy use. Whether it's staying in bed, because obviously then you won't shiver, or whether it's getting naked so that you reduce sweating perhaps, whatever it may be, there is an energetic consequence to everything you do in responding to the environment. And Fry tried to articulate this. In Fry's paradigm then, what are the guiding principles, what are the axioms of the paradigm? There are considered to be four axioms for Fry's paradigm and a couple of important corollaries, and the corollaries plus some of the axioms link back to what we talked about on Friday, balanced energy equation. The first axiom is that the principle of conservation of energy applies. And how do we see that expressed in an energetic framework for fish? Correct. The energy they get in the food is equal to the energy for metabolism and growth, which is the balanced energy equation. This is just the higher order organization in which things are fitted, and that is essentially you can't have any bits and pieces hanging out. You have to have everything accounted for in terms of the energy budget of the fish. The second axiom is very important, because it says that metabolic requirements are met first. If there is a change in the environment, there is a metabolic energetic consequence. In other words, if you choose to run from the motor because you're suffocating in the boat well from the fumes in the motor, there is energy required for you to not only make a decision, which is a small amount of energy, but to run from the boat well, for example. If you choose to lie around in bed on that cold morning, it means that there's an energetic consequence in that you're remaining in a micro habitat where your energy expenditure actually is going to be lower. But if you decide to go out on a brisk walk instead, then to maintain your temperature, then obviously energy is expended there. After 4 or 5 hours in waders, energy has been expended in significant quantities to fill your waders with sweat. And energy is delightfully expended when you then go for a swim in the cool water at the end. Okay, so Fred Fry reckoned, and I think he's probably right, that in general, metabolic requirements are met first. You respond to the environment in a metabolic framework, and they are met first. These metabolic requirements, to think of some corollaries now, are going to be met from the physiologically useful energy, which is the energy that is left over after paying those taxes, the fecal loss, the nitrogenous loss, and the apparent heat increment, all the procedures that precede the assimilation and making available the various substrates from food. A critical corollary here, though, is that given the balanced energy equation, where P is the proportion of energy that's lost in the various taxes, R is the ration, it must equal metabolism and growth, for a given amount of food input, all the metabolic requirements are met first. Therefore, the surplus is available for growth, including reproductive products. Mentioned this on Friday. The surplus is available. So for those ecologically critical factors, for the evolutionarily important factors, it's the surplus only that is available after all the living costs are paid. Okay? So an important corollary here is that if metabolic requirements are met first, then growth and material for metabolism is based on a surplus. The third axiom, which essentially I've already described to you, is that all animal responses to the environment are ultimately met at the metabolic level. All responses to the environment are ultimately met at the metabolic level. A change in the environment, then, has a metabolic consequence. Change in the environment ultimately met at the metabolic level. This also has an important corollary, which follows directly from here. And that is, the growth responses, the surplus, is going to be inversely related to the metabolic response for a given amount of food available. And remember, food is typically limiting. In other words, if the metabolic rate increases, there will be a smaller surplus. Conversely, if the animal behaves in such a way as to lower its metabolic rate by choosing an appropriate habitat, for example, the surplus can increase. But there's an inverse relationship between growth and metabolism. The fourth axiom is that there are a limited set of responses. In terms of animal function, there are only a few ways that animals actually respond to the environment. And this is quite in contrast to the technological ways that we may measure the environment. When it comes to how animals respond to the environment, then there is a relatively limited set of ways in which animals respond to the environment. There are actually five of these. And let me introduce these to you. And I'm going to develop a flow diagram here. So I strongly recommend you leave a piece of area in your notes so that we can fill this in as I develop the pieces. Okay. First of all, there are two major categories of ways in which animals can respond to the environment. These are lethal and sublethal. You can quickly deduce there are some factors in the environment that kill, and the response of the animal is to turn over with its little fins in the air and say goodbye, cruel world. Alternatively, there are whole other things that can affect animals that do not kill them. Now, the lethal factors, virtually anything can be a lethal factor. Too high a temperature can kill. Too low a temperature can kill. Too little oxygen can kill. Actually, too much oxygen can kill. Carbon dioxide, all the things we can measure, can be at high enough levels that they can kill organisms. However, death does not occur instantly, at least for most things. Unlike, say, in Terminator, when the bomb goes off and everyone's fried within seconds, usually the environment doesn't kill quite as fast. It kills relatively slowly. So a lot of animals can enter situations that would, if they stayed there, would eventually kill them, and they can wander in there for a while. Turns out that there is a resistance zone. If we think of some environmental variable, such as temperature, which we can measure, there is some point out here where if the animal stayed, it would die. And there is another level out here where it is totally sublethal. Let's think of a trout. What temperatures are likely to kill a trout if a trout stream goes up and stays at those sorts of temperatures? Tony? say 25. So the ultimate lethal level for something we can measure for a trout might be 25C. What sort of temperatures might be important if the thing's just sort of not feeling too great? Maybe down here at 24, 22, say? They can remain at 22, that it's pushing it a bit. Well, trout can still move into this zone, because in this zone, they will resist death, and therefore it's called a zone of resistance. They can resist death for a while, even though if they stay there, they could die. This is quite important because, say, in a lake such as Douglas Lake that stratifies and we have a thermocline, we have warm water above and cool water below. Now, the water above might be, well, what's the temperature at the surface of Douglas Lake just at the moment? 24? Oh, darn, there goes that example. What was the temperature at Cliver Dam? Was it 27? Something like that? Okay. But in the bottom of Cliver Dam, the temperature was probably pretty low, probably down maybe as low as 15, 16. So there's nothing to stop a trout coming up into this 27-degree water for just long enough to snatch off some poor, innocent, unsuspecting minnow. So fish in lakes such as these, such as the cold water fish, may come inshore to the warm water, potentially lethal water, say to feed. Those perch we caught in the gill net, I'm sorry to remind you of that, they have come from the cooler waters moving onshore to feed. Now, Chris and Jay are picking up some of these movements of the fishes in their project to see just how much they are. And the larger fish typically are down in the cooler waters and they're moving upshore. And you are finding, probably not today in view of the weather, but certainly on the first run, you found the inshore-offshore movements of some of those fish. And what they're doing is, in spite of the fact that the surface temperatures, if they stayed there, would be lethal, they can still go in there for a while to exploit the resources and then run off, run back home to the cool water. So in this lethal, in terms of lethal factors, there is an ultimate lethal level for anything we can measure that will eventually have a, well, biological response, a sort of behavioral response, in that the animals will die, okay? But it always takes time to die, and fish can exploit the resistance zone between the completely sublethal level of a factor and the ultimately lethal level. They can go in there for a while, come out, and so on. So in the boat well, while we're getting the engine going, in spite of the fact that the smoke becomes blue with fumes and bad language, we can still tolerate that carbon monoxide for a short period of time, if we're stupid enough to, but we can still tolerate it for a while, right? How many of you have seen the Full Monty? Not many of you have seen the Full Monty, yeah. You know, that guy was able to be pulled out of the car where he was trying to commit suicide because it does take a while and thereby saved his life. And if you haven't seen the Full Monty, have you seen the Full Monty? You should see the Full Monty in your spare time. Okay, so these are lethal factors. One thing to mention about lethal factors is that it's a very common method used in monitoring the environment. And it's used in bioassays. There are many forms of bioassays, but a very common form is this lethal bioassay, where they will expose organisms such as fish to a wide range of, say, temperatures, PCB levels, and so on, and construct a curve to try and find the relationship between dose and death. Drug companies do this kind of thing, although they are trying to find the relationship between dose and life, of course, those kinds of things. But the bioassay is a very standard method for pollution control and these kinds of things. It's a very easy technique to use because it's very easy to tell when a fish is belly up and therefore dead. But I hope you'll realize that as a technique for monitoring the environment, it's really pretty stupid. After all, if you're in monitoring the environment, you actually want living organisms, not dead organisms. So why do you measure death in order to provide something that is safe? There's a logical disconnect there. The problem is it's easy, And there are other and better ways, but very much more expensive ways, if you're interested in life. Okay, well, those are the lethal levels. So there's the lethal level. Now let me think about the, and this causes death. Or it destroys the functional integrity of the organism, which I always thought meant death. And these do not cause death. Now, there are two major categories amongst this sublethal group. The first is a set that affects the amount of energy that can be made available. So it determines the amount of energy for metabolism. And there are another set of factors that determine the distribution of energy, in other words, how it is used. Because in thinking of the way animals respond, they're going to use energy for various things, and those things are going to be changed by the environment. But before the environment can cause a change in the use, the environment also is going to affect how much is going to be available. How much is going to be available? And let's look at this set first, because there are two groups in here that determine how much is available. One are environmental factors or controlling factors, and another is a set called limiting factors. These together determine how much metabolic energy an animal has in order to interact with the environment. Let's look at these in sequence. Controlling factors, first of all, are fundamentally going back to the chemistry that you thought you'd left behind you, the physics that you thought you would never see again. Well, as we've seen already, these things keep rearing their ugly heads. Does anyone remember anything about enzyme substrate affinities? Yeah, I see some heads nodding. Well, you'll recall that a certain amount of energy is required for an enzyme to bind with its substrate and thereby participate in an enzyme-catalyzed reaction. And the amount of energy that's available depends on the kinetic energy, and of course we can quantify the kinetic energy in terms of our measurements of temperature. Okay, so you need a certain amount of energy. What happens if the amount of energy that is available in the substrates and so on increases? Metabolic rates, enzyme catalyzed reactions start going faster, don't they? Therefore, any environmental factor that affects the kinetic energy of the reactants is going to cause chemical reactions to go faster. So these controlling factors are factors that actually affect the rates of biochemical reactions. Now, you'll also remember from the laws of mass action that the rate of a metabolic reaction depends on the concentration of the products and the physical condition of the products. We also know then that anything that influences, say, volume changes and so on, will also affect rates of reaction. For example, suppose an enzyme and a substrate combine, and in doing so, there's a volume increase. Anything that prevents such a volume increase is going to inhibit that reaction. So things that also affect spatial factors about reactions also can alter things in the environment that can halt change. Things in the environment that can affect the spatial changes during reactions, for example, can influence them. Now, in terms of human technology and measurement, what are the two factors in the environment that we could measure that will influence the fundamental biochemical properties of metabolism?
Temperature.
Temperature is our indirect measure of heat energy and kinetic energy and so on. And what about volume changes? Pressure. fish as species and or as individuals are exposed to a huge range of temperatures and potentially a huge range of pressures. These can affect rates of reactions and therefore the amount of energy that is available. If we were to plot a relationship, say, between temperature and metabolic rate, we would find then as temperature increases that the active metabolic rate increases, and so does the standard metabolic rate. Okay, the active metabolic rate and the standard metabolic rate. These two shaped curves are not a slip of the pen. The active metabolic rate does tend to increase more linearly with temperature, whereas the standard metabolic rate tends to increase curvilinearly, essentially doubling for every 10 degree change in temperature. In fact, we measure the effect of metabolic rate on temperature. We quantify the effect of temperature on metabolic rate by a quantity that we call Q10, which is the rate at any temperature at 10 degrees higher than that at a lower temperature. You should be familiar with Q10 from basic biology. Is anyone not familiar with Q10? Okay, then obviously basic biology failed. Let me digress a little here. There is no fundamental physical set of principles to describe the precise effect of temperature on enzyme-catalyzed reactions in real organisms. Organisms are way too complicated for some simple physics to describe exactly what is happening. But because temperature has such a huge rate on metabolic rates, because of its fundamental biochemical effects, biologists do need a way to communicate with each other about the effects of temperature. So they invented this Q10. And Q10 is just a descriptor. So if I take the rate of metabolism at this temperature and say it's 10 milligrams of oxygen per hour, and I look 10 degrees higher and I measure it again, then maybe it's 20 milligrams of oxygen per hour. So at the higher temperature it was 20, at the lower rate it was 10. That gives you a value of Q10 of 2. And typically, metabolic reactions increase by a factor of 2 for every 10 degree increase in temperature. That's quite a steep geometric function, and you can realize that over a 40 or 50 degree temperature range that is typical of fishes over the globe, that's a huge change in temperature. That is accounted for by adaptations in the enzymes, as you might expect. If we look at metabolic scope, which you will recall is active minus standard, you wind up with a curved sort of relationship. Because of the shape of the standard metabolism, the scope for metabolism is relatively lower at higher pressures, and it is also low at very low pressures or at very low temperatures or at high temperatures.
The x-axis
is still temperature. Thanks, Sarah. You'll notice that there's a hump in the middle. At that hump in the middle, the metabolic scope is largest. This means that where the metabolic scope is largest, the fish have the largest amount of energy that they can make available, a surplus energy, I shouldn't use surplus, because that's for growth, but the largest amount of energy in which they can deal with environmental change. Where the metabolic scope is highest, they can change the metabolic rate by the largest amount in order to deal with the unexpected. Running for the bus, for example, when you suddenly need a big increase in energy. That is the place where metabolic scope is highest. And for this reason, this is sometimes defined as an optimum temperature. Recall, when I told you that people say talk about an optimum this or an optimum that, always ask what the criteria are. This optimum temperature is defined as that that maximizes the metabolic scope. And we can do the same thing with pressure or any other factor that directly affects the biochemical properties at a fundamental level. And temperature and pressure are the things we measure that can do that. Now, some interesting experiments have been done at various times where, for example, fish have been put in a metal trough in which you heat one end and cool the other so it sets up a temperature gradient. And you then look in this trough and you see, where do fish prefer to be? Do they have a preferred temperature? And what is it? Well, fish do have preferred temperatures. And they will choose those temperatures whenever you put them in a trough in a temperature gradient. It just so happens that the preferred temperature, well, I don't think it just so happens, but it so happens that the preferred temperature of a fish is that at which the metabolic scope is maximized. So this optimum, as determined by physiologists, proves also to be the preferred temperature for fishes. It is believed, and this is at least confirming evidence, that fish will tend, and it was believed before this was shown, that fish should choose temperatures that maximize their metabolic scope, that maximize their capability of responding to changes in the environment. That makes sense, doesn't it? If things are going to change and you don't know quite how, give yourself as much pillow, as much cushion as possible. Okay? This applies metabolically as well as putting you guys through college or whatever it may be. In my case, looking at retirement and goofing off and so on. You know, have as much slack as you can. It applies metabolically as well.
So Fry made that prediction before that.
Fry did indeed. And some guy wanted to pad his publication record. You've all heard of padding publication records. Spent years doing this experiment of publishing one fish's preferred temperature and then another and then another and then another until he was the laughing stock. He had a huge, long publication thing. Absolute laughing stock. A warning for those who believe in the least publishable unit. Okay, these are controlling factors. They control the rate of metabolism by the fundamental effect on the state of activation of matter and the way in which biochemical reactions take place. It doesn't matter what you necessarily measure. This is a common biological response for a suite of factors that technology can measure and we can call temperature and pressure. But the principle in terms of animal responses occurs in terms of biochemical reactions, the fundamental biochemical reactions that underlie metabolism. Now, it's all very well having a metabolic capability that is set by these controlling factors. But you can only realize that potential if there is nothing in the way. You only realize that potential if there is nothing in the way. For example, you have tremendous potential up here to learn all sorts of things. However, if you have to eat in the cafeteria for 8 solid weeks, then you're likely to go crazy and you won't realize the full potential, right? You have to get out of camp occasionally. That's a somewhat arcane limiting factor, but illustrates the point. In terms of the responses to the environment, any factor in the environment that prevents an organism from realizing its metabolic capability, that is defined as a limiting factor. Now, continuing with our metabolic framework, let's think of, say, metabolism, C6H12O6 equals 6CO2 plus 6H2O plus energy. Okay, this is what we're doing. This is the overall equation for the metabolism of carbohydrates with oxygen. Oh, we've missed out the oxygen. The overall metabolism of carbohydrate by burning it with oxygen. What happens if there's not enough oxygen? going to slow the rate of metabolism, isn't it? In other words, the things like temperature and pressure, controlling factors, will determine the potential rate for this reaction. But if oxygen is limiting, you won't realize the potential. If carbon dioxide is not removed, then you know from the laws of mass action that you'll slow this reaction and the potential won't be realized. If we were looking at the metabolism of an amino acid, if the nitrogen was not being removed fast enough, then that would limit the reaction. Limiting factors then typically interfere with the supply of metabolites and or the removal of waste products. So factors that limit metabolism, that prevent the metabolism from realizing the potential set by the controlling factors, those factors preventing that potential being realized are considered limiting factors. They limit the potential from being realized, and they are typically the metabolites, the substrates, or the products of metabolism that have to be supplied at adequate rates or have to be removed at adequate rates. April, did you have a question?
Yeah, I
repeated it. Okay. I think this is pretty obvious. And it doesn't matter what we measure. Okay? Anything that interrupts metabolism in this way has the same metabolic consequence for the organism, and that is it limits the metabolism. It doesn't matter whether it's high levels of, say, zinc in the environment, which damages the gills. It doesn't matter if it's low oxygen. It doesn't matter if it's high carbon dioxide. It doesn't matter if it's an accumulation of waste products. It just simply doesn't matter. The metabolic response of the animal is identical in all of those situations. And if you know that something is a limiting factor, you know what it's going to do. And if you measure something new, or you know what suites of chemicals do, you know what the animal response is. You don't have to study every single individual jot and tittle and so on in the environment, because you can often deduce the category of response it's likely to be, and therefore know what the animal is going to do. Well, let us think what happens with a limiting factor, because we get to some interesting kinds of results here. Let's look at metabolism again, and we'll look at the controlling factor as a function of temperature, and here's the active metabolic rate and here's the standard metabolic rate. A limiting factor, something that interrupts metabolism, is likely to have its greatest effect when the energy demand is highest. For example, if you're just going for a walk in the middle of Ann Arbor, where the carbon monoxide levels are substantially higher than up here, you know, that's fine. But if on, you know, Saturday night when the traffic's crawling down Main Street and you're sitting having your coffee, you know, and then you have to run somewhere, it's when you have to run somewhere that suddenly the pollution effects are likely to be realized. So that limiting factors have their largest effects when animals are pushed towards their limits. They tend to depress, then, the maximum potential you can realize. Now, if you look at the metabolic scope now as the same function of temperature, and we have this relationship normally, when you subtract off this maximum, find an interesting thing happens. First of all, the range of habitats in which an animal can live has been restricted as a result of this limiting factor. It can no longer live in the full range of environmental possibilities that might be possible with just thinking of temperature or pressure alone. This additional environmental factor has limited the range of environments in which the animal will now choose to live. Adding this second factor, then, has restricted the set of habitats in which the animal can live. This part of the course, we're talking about what factors determine where animals may live. And you can begin to see that this physiological approach that Fry is putting together is beginning to contour the space, if you like, in which an animal may live. And maybe it's doing it in a way that's fully quantifiable, something that we can measure and put in our computers as wonderful three-dimensional displays and so on. We can contour the space where animals may live, which is, after all, the goal of this first part of the course. Something else is interesting. Note that here is the optimal temperature because metabolic scope has increased. But now with this factor, the scope is maximized at a somewhat lower temperature. This means then that if the preferred temperature for a fish, where a fish chooses to live, is determined where the metabolic scope is maximized, the interaction of these factors is going to make this fish now choose a different environment in terms of, in this case, temperature. And that's what happens. In experiments that are done where fish are given choices in habitats, when you begin to add on these factors that are now limiting metabolism, instead of choosing the habitat that, in the absence of limiting factors, maximize scope, they choose a new habitat that still maximizes the metabolic scope, but it's a different habitat. So this approach in thinking about how animals respond, how you describe your response to the environment. Fish are doing the same kinds of things. The environment is not measured by a fish in terms of temperature or radiation levels or UVB and those kinds of things, but in terms of its behavior in ways that affect its metabolism, exactly the way you described your behavior with respect to heat and cold. And just as we could define your preferred habitat and where you lived and so on in terms of those behaviors, so you can by fish, and there's just these limited number of factors, categories, that do so. Okay? So these two sets of factors determine the amount of energy that's available for metabolism, and therefore the amount of scope, if you like, available to respond to changes in the environment. The animals choose factors that maximize the cushion, environments that maximize the cushion in terms of these controlling and limiting factors. And again, it doesn't matter what you measure, this is a demonstrable metabolic response, and the animal's behavior is such as to achieve these metabolic maxima in terms of scope. You're with me? It's a pretty dry subject, I know. Stop smiling. Okie doke. Distribution of energy. There are two sets of factors now that determine how the energy is actually used. Let me see if I can get it all on here. One of these is regulatory, and the other is directive. Let me take these two one by one. Animals are made up of a whole complex of systems, right the way from their biochemistry through to the whole organism and so on. And the purpose of all those is to provide some sort of environment in the cells for the metabolism, so continuing functioning optimally, these kinds of things. In other words, we are a mass of regulated systems. And those regulated systems are designed to provide a buffer between desirable conditions inside the animal for the biochemical aspects of metabolism and the all-too-variable environment, which can vary in ways that are not always predictable. How many people were expecting a storm this morning? I wasn't. I hung my washing on the line last night. Yeah, it wasn't much. I'm a clean guy. So there are a whole bunch of situations, regulated situations. If there is a change in the environment, temperature, PCBs, carbon monoxide, mother-in-laws, you don't know about that yet, or whatever it may be, change in the environment that affects a regulated system, then something is going to happen to push that system back to wherever its set point is or whatever. That requires a change in energy use. In other words, from the energy that was made available from the environment, for the energy that is made available as a result of the interaction of controlling and limiting factors, now if there is a change in a regulated system, some energy is going to be shunted somewhere in order to deal with that regulated system. If you're stressed and you have a high energy use and things sort of get easy in 4 weeks' time, your energy consumption may go down. Now, it doesn't matter what you can measure. It doesn't matter whether we're talking about heavy metals, PCBs, levels of carbon monoxide that make you uncomfortable, changes in the global carbon dioxide level, all these kinds of things. It doesn't matter. The fish respond energetically in the same kind of way. They shunt energy into this regulated system to correct a perturbation. Just as you turn on the heat, turn on the air conditioning to regulate temperature, animals are doing exactly the same kinds of things. And let's think about what happens here. And again, I will continue to set up in terms of a controlling factor and the metabolic rate. And here we have the active metabolic rate. Here we have the standard metabolic rate. And here we have the scope. Now, we define standard metabolic rate as something that keeps body and soul together and all those kinds of things. Well, if a regulated system is changed or has to work differently, then you see this as an increase in the standard metabolism, opposite to the limiting effect that we saw earlier. However, the effect is quite the same kind of thing for the regulating factor as it is that we saw for the limiting factor. The optimum temperature is shifted, there's a new optimum temperature, and the range of habitats that can be occupied is also shifted. The principle, wow, becomes the same, a common principle now. That factors then that begin to interfere with each other all have the same thing. They interact in ways that limits the range of something in which the animal can live, the range of environments in which the fish can live, or any other organism for that matter. And it also shifts the optimum environment, the one that is that the fish will choose to maximize its cushion, its scope for activity. Sarah, did you have a question?
So you're saying that the need to use a regulatory system increases your standard environment?
Typically, a change in the environment from the preferred environment can be thought of as an addition to standard metabolism. It increases the energy required just to keep body and soul together. For you in winter with inadequate central heating, you will make up for the inadequate central heating, as so often happens in campus housing, I understand, make up for that by increasing your metabolism. If it really gets cold, you'll start shivering, but you'll still crank up your metabolism a little. On the other hand, in the summer, when you'll be sweating like a pig, all the energy will be required for that if you don't have air conditioning. And these can be seen as an increase in the minimum energy, the standard metabolic rate, in order to keep body and soul together. Stressors of all sorts will do the same thing. All the chemical stressors and so on that are in the environment will tend to do the same kinds of things. The response of the organism to this category is always the same. The consequences are entirely predictable in terms of energy supply and therefore in terms of the range of habitats where the animal may be able to live and indeed in terms of the preferred habitats for the animal. Did you leave lots of space? The last category is directive responses. And there are two types in here. And these are things that affect the animal's use of energy in space and in time. And that figure is now complete. Let's think of the use of energy in space. We're in the boat well. We pull the engine, the starting cord on the whaler. Nothing happens. Blue smoke comes in. You know, you're starting to cough and choke because I forgot to put the whaler outside before doing this, knowing the consequences. What do? You run out. In this case, you are using energy in space to redistribute in space. You are changing your location, and the metabolic consequence is that driving locomotion. So in this case, the blue smoke from the engine is directing you in space, and that direction in space involves the expenditure of energy. And it would appear in the same kind of ways of if it was a sustained energy requirement that was directing you in space, then that would have the effect, obviously, on environmental choices. But it's pretty obvious that if you move from one place to another, these directing factors are affecting the distribution of the organism into different environments. Something else we can measure, such as oxygen. If oxygen levels are low, fish will move to different habitats. The low oxygen, the environmental condition that the animal wants to avoid, will direct it in space. Things that attract animals, such as dog food in minnow traps, an olfactory cue in the environment, can direct a fish in space. Okay? And as a result, it's going to change the habitat in which the animal lives. Now, we've got some fisher people here. Out in Lake Erie, you fish in Lake Erie? Do you eat the fish in Lake Erie? Okay. If you have a choice between the thermal plume from the Cook power plant or the rest of Lake Erie, where are you likely to find the biggest fish?
The bottom?
In the plume or the open lake? The bottom, so close to the surface in Lake Erie. Okay, well, you haven't experienced this then, but fishermen say you catch the biggest fish by thermal plumes. Power plants are good for us. They provide big fish. This is a case where a lot of the predators will accumulate near these productive areas to feed, and they have been attracted. They've been redirected in space by, in this case, the thermal environment in such a way that they can increase their energy consumption. So these are factors that direct animals in space. You can also see that animals are directed in time. February this year, it was still grey in Ann Arbor, wasn't it? How did you feel in April when the sun came out? Good? Great? Terrific? You know, they say when spring comes, a young man's fancy turns. Now, why is that? Things are happening in time. The environment is variable, but there are certain clues in the environment. Things like photoperiod, temperature period are major factors. They correlate with major events in the environment, and many of them happen to do with good times to reproduce and those kinds of things, and tend to be associated with sex. But there's also getting ready for winter. When winter comes, fish go and hide, those kinds of places. So factors in the environment can also influence the way fishes respond in time, particularly seasonally, for reproduction, for parental care, for migration, and those kinds of things. These again involve energy expenditures. I'm told that sex requires a lot of energy. Perhaps you could advise me sometime. That energy sort of has to come from somewhere. Hence the pre-seduction meal, perhaps, that we were talking about the other day. but anyway, as you can see, there are energetic consequences, though, in preparing animals in time for various events that are happening in the environment and their life. And again, this energy is entirely, the energy use is entirely predictable, and in the same way as we talked about with limiting and regulating factors, so that fish should choose environments to maximize their available energy in space and time as well. Now, I focused on metabolism, but for every single one of these, any factor that has an effect that increases metabolism is going to tend to decrease growth. I'm not going to go into that with any detail, but I'm sure you can realize that we could run through all of these factors and look at the growth implications, so that we could think about how a controlling factor influences use of energy, the acquisition of energy, and those kinds of things. I'm not going to do that, because it all essentially follows from the balanced energy equation. And given a certain amount of food, you know what are going to be the growth consequences. You know what are going to be the growth consequences for a change in metabolism. And food tends to be limited. Therefore, anything in the environment that increases the metabolic needs tends to reduce growth. It tends to reduce the surplus available for growth and reproductive products. Now, a lot of animals are already walking a tightrope in terms of the surplus energy available for growth, reproduction, and for survival. So a factor in the environment that reduces the surplus available is obviously going to have an impact on the persistence of an animal in its environment. So again, we can see how this framework can begin to contour where animals can live and where they do not live. Now, for that reason, looking at metabolic responses is a very, very good way of bioassaying and monitoring. This traditional bioassay that kills animals, as I pointed out, is looking at the wrong thing. We're not interested in killing organisms. We're interested in the conditions whereby they can persist in a healthy way. And I would suggest to you that metabolic responses that you can measure relatively easily, and now with computers and so on, you can do them in bulk, is a much more sensible way of thinking about and monitoring the environment. And with a framework such as the one that Fry advocates, you know, the choices in which you can fit things are relatively small. You know what's going to happen. And you then know for different chemical species. You don't have to measure all the chemical species. If you know a little bit about the periodic table, then you know that certain metals are all going to have the same effect. You don't need to study all of them. So you set up also a predictive framework that can obviously be more economical in terms of animals sacrificed, time, space, money, and those kinds of things. The only caveat I do want to add that is primarily mainly important in production situations, is that in terms of the total intake, the said energy is typically limiting, so therefore a change in metabolism will have an effect on growth. But in culture situations, you can regulate that. And as you increase the temperature, or since we don't usually modify pressure in culture situations, you can begin to manipulate the growth rates. Because the rates of metabolism go up with a controlling factor effect, fish can also eat more and grow faster if the food is available and the temperature is higher. This is why fish are born early in the spring, when all the food is popping out, to take advantage of that. But ultimately, food is limiting in most environments, but this does become important in culture situations. Okay, I want to finish this by looking at some of the strengths and weaknesses that are involved here. Because some of Fred Fry's students, 20 years ago, actually, it was, but it was kind of fun at the time, and some people still believe this is all you need in order to describe where fish live, and that you can quantify exactly where a fish will and should live. You can describe the environment in terms of measurable parameters. You can actually contour that n-dimensional hyperspace that is the niche. Does anybody know what an n-dimensional hyperspace is like? I can't even conceive of it. But anyway, here is a way to contour the environment, to actually put numbers on the n-dimensional hyperspace that is this arcane definition of the niche that was handed down to us, I guess, by Hutchinson and Co., right? We can do it. We can actually define where the fish can live. And that was a great argument which involved Steve Kerr and Earl Werner, who's an ecologist at Michigan, because Werner essentially said to Steve Kerr, in print, "This is the biggest load of carp I've ever seen." Well, why is that? Here we have a device where you really can measure everything, and you can contour this n-dimensional hyperspace in measurable quantities and all these kinds of things. Surely then we can say where the fish lives. Well, yes, we can. We can use this kind of approach, plus the biomechanical approaches on locomotion and feeding mechanisms and so on, to define where a fish may live, and that is its fundamental niche. Fundamental niche is where a fish may live. The problem is, it doesn't tell you where a fish does live, or any other organism. And Earl Werner really absolutely socked this poor guy in the chops, just knocked him flat, because he said, your approach cannot predict what happens when you add a competitor to the situation or a predator to the environment. Okay? There is no way that you can predict what will happen when those biological factors change. Sure, if you add a predator to the system, we can say, yes, the metabolism may increase as the fish flees from the predator more often. And we can talk about how the presence of a competitor might reduce the amount of food that's available and reduce the surplus for growth, and therefore, and so on. Yes, we can talk about that, but we can't really predict what's going to happen to the metabolism. Well, we can actually predict what's going to happen to the metabolism of the fish that is caught, but we can't predict the population dynamics. You can't predict the community structure. You cannot, in other words, predict the realized niche. You can't predict the realized niche, which includes both the biotic factors and the abiotic factors, plus the third element, which is chance, that I'll be talking about later. So why go through all this stuff? In terms of understanding fish capabilities, in order to understand how fish respond to a changing environment. Certainly, in understanding how fish respond to a human-modified environment, in terms of the physical, chemical composition of that environment, this is a very strong and useful framework. It is extremely useful, the things we've been talking about so far, in understanding where a fish may live. It's an extremely powerful approach for predicting where fish may live in ways that are testable. Science advances by formulating testable questions and, in theory, falsifying those hypotheses. This is an ideal way of saying, hey, this is where a fish should be. And if it isn't, what is going on? It helps also articulate the questions about the realized niche and things that are important. For many fish, the fundamental niche is the ones that they do in fact occupy as well. It also happens to coincide with the realized niche. But it is incomplete. Since you cannot predict what's going to happen at the population, the community levels, what happens if you add a competitor, what happens if you add a predator, or what happens if a chance event such as this morning storm comes by? Can't handle any of those. And those are the factors that are added on top of these fundamental niche ideas to affect the ultimate distribution of fishes. And there I will stop for a short break. Any questions? There's a lot of material in here, and it does require a mindset which is a little different from the one you're used to. The mindset you're used to in science classes is measurable quantities using human technology. This is a mindset that tries to take an animal eye response-related view of the world. So it's a little different. And my experience has been that you probably need to think a little about this. And of course, we'll have a review session later. Okay? Any questions? Terrific. Well, can we reconvene? I've got a few pieces of business and odds and ends I have to deal with, and I want to say a little bit about how things are going with the projects. So I'd like to reconvene, if we could, at 9:30. Remember, there is good coffee in the store. Okay?
What's good coffee?